The following is a special program from the CPR Newsroom. In New York, I'm Don DeBar. This past Friday, we spoke with Professor Anthony Montero and analyst Eric Dreitzer about the status of the presidential campaign. Quite a wild debate, so-called, last night. Okay, just more icing on top of the cake. Eric Dreitzer and Professor Anthony Montero, welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Don.
Let's start with Eric. Eric, what did you think about the level of discussion at this point where we're talking about Donald Trump Jr.? What do you think about this?
Well, I assume we're referring to his male anatomy and not his children. Mm-hmm. And I guess there's not much difference between the two, really. I mean, they're both pretty irrelevant in the grand scheme of all of this. Mm-hmm. But what I think is significant in all of this is really the sociological question, the rise of Trump, what this means. There's a political issue, I think, that is being totally ignored, not surprisingly, by the corporate media, and that is that this is basically the equivalent of inviting a dinner guest over for a dinner party and then realizing that he set fire to your house, because that's basically what Donald Trump has done. He seems to be bringing down the Republican Party as we know it. And this is actually being stated quite openly by the Washington Post, the New York Times, many others. And I think it's quite obvious, because if you actually look at what Trump is talking about, some of the issues, he's going against the conventional wisdom of what the Republican Party is about. While on the one hand, he's obviously playing to a overt racist element that is always at the sort of the core of the Republican Party, but that has been conveniently hidden from view, he has brought that out into the open. Simultaneously, I mean, he's taking some positions that, quite frankly, are to the left of Hillary Clinton when it comes to, you know, a number of issues. He's openly talking about the insanity of the evangelical crusade against Planned Parenthood. He's talking about, you know, certain things in regards to healthcare. None of this should be taken as progressive, because it's not. But what it is going against the conventional wisdom of the Republican Party. And that is what I'm talking about here. He has essentially created a civil war inside of the Republican Party. From the perspective of those of us who exist outside of the established political apparatus, outside of the two dominant parties, which are in effect one oligarch corporate party with two wings, this is a good thing. We're watching the destruction of one party, while the Democratic Party is in many ways also at war with itself between the progressive wing and the corporate wing. Now, I don't think that we're going to see the Democratic Party fracturing in the way the Republican Party has, but from those of us who want to see both parties destroyed, we have to be quite pleased.
What about you, Professor Montero?
Yeah, it's very clear that as a personality on the political stage, Donald Trump is kind of an absurdist, cartoonish figure. But below the drama and theatrics that define Donald Trump is a movement of disaffected white, mainly working class and lower middle class, although not exclusively them, people who close to 40 years ago were seduced and brought into the Republican Party under the paradigm of the Southern strategy and then the Reagan Revolution, where they abandon any notion of class solidarity for race identity, and the whole discourse, be it on the religious or cultural wars or all of these issues of abortion, at the end of the day, and the subtext was white supremacy. So the very white working people, what came to be called Reagan Democrats, we could also have called them George Wallace Democrats, who abandoned class for whiteness and race supremacy, are now caught in a double crisis of both the white supremacist ideology and social system, which is unable to produce for them what the outcomes that they were told it would produce, and on the other side, which is not separate but interacts with it, a deepening crisis of the American economic neoliberal system. Now, this means that they are in open rebellion against the very elites that promised them that if you followed us down the path of whiteness and white supremacy and broke all relationships, even in unions, to black and brown and immigrants and women, let us say, if you took the path of whiteness, that you would be guaranteed a future. And that has all collapsed. And it is interesting because in a certain way, the logic was already embedded in the project, again, that goes back over close to 40 years now. It was already embedded there that whiteness could not resolve the crisis of capitalism. I think we are witnessing the end of the two-party duopoly. Donald Trump, if he does not know anything else, knows that he is leading a rebellion against the Republican Party elites in the name of the working class and poor white folk. They don't want to hear anything from Mitt Romney. They don't want to hear anything from anyone who has this well-crafted presence on the political stage of respectability, of whiteness, of white maleness. They don't want to hear any of that. And I think this rebellion has not just immediate consequences, but long-term consequences. And this is the last thing I would say. I think what is going on in the Republican Party is going to infect the Democratic primary season going forward. I think what we see, this boldness, this brashness, this I don't give a damn attitude that Trump brings to the political stage is going to be demanded of Bernie Sanders. Now, it's going to be difficult for him because he's not a reality TV personality. But the same type of intense rejection of the establishment is going, I think, to have a greater presence in the Democratic primaries going forward, because the same thing, the same objective factors driving the Trump movement are the same objective economic factors driving the Bernie Sanders thing. And Don, if I could just add one last thing,
sure.
Because the the absent, so to speak, factor in this whole project at this point is what will African Americans do? And I would suggest that the African American people as a group are still watching and looking and seeing how this drama among white people and the white masses in conflict with the white elite will play out. But I can guarantee you, black people will make their presence felt before this thing is over. They have not yet, in spite of what the bourgeois media is saying. Those southern primaries don't tell us very, very much because the turnouts are so small and the vote is so controlled. But I think when black people make their presence known, I think it will accelerate all of the processes of rebellion.
Yeah, you have at the bottom of all of this intense anger, a disaffection, and a rejection of the structures, really, driving both of them. What do you think, Eric, going forward in terms of these, I don't know, like, they're almost like the blob, these movements. They're so amorphous. But these movements that are forming, you know, sort of spontaneously, apparently spontaneously, because, of course, it's not likely that any of them are going to find the fullest expression of their sentiment if it materialized as something discernible by any of the candidates.
Well, look, I agree with a lot of what my dear friend Tony was saying. However, not to be the proverbial wet blanket in the conversation here, but I do believe that we may be overstating not only the level of courage of a Bernie Sanders, the level of ability to actually radicalize himself in terms of his rhetoric and ability to radicalize his own so-called movement. I don't see any objective evidence that that is happening. I think that he has had a number of opportunities to do that. I think it's quite clear that there have been irregularities, to say the least, in Iowa, irregularities in Nevada. He did not use his political apparatus to challenge either of those states. There was no legal inquiry funded by the Sanders campaign. There was no media blast by the Sanders people pointing out the irregularities, pointing out all of these things. That was done by a very small fragment of the so-called progressive press that really pushed those issues, and they're almost forgotten now. Without that, without Sanders having been able to show that level of tenacity there, I'm not seeing it in particular now that the blob of Donald Trump and the Trumpist, if I can say that without laughing, movement has reared its ugly head. Look, we know the power of the politics of fear in the United States. We know the power of what Donald Trump represents as far as white supremacy, as far as racism, or what I would call America's very unique form of fascism. That is ultimately what Donald Trump is mobilizing here, whether he knows that or not. This is, you know, whether he is consciously doing this or simply riding the wave of what he sees as legitimate discontent, including the white supremacists. Movements and factions and so forth. The reality is, this is probably the greatest gift that Hillary Clinton could ever have received, because ultimately Hillary Clinton is so odious to her own party, so odious to her own to the progressive base of the Democratic Party, if such a thing can be called the base, that it almost takes a Donald Trump to force the progressives to hold their nose and vote for Hillary Clinton. I can tell you in conversations I'm having with regular old liberals who have not totally broken ties with, to my own shame, they are voicing precisely that. They are saying, well, I hate Hillary Clinton, but I cannot allow Donald Trump to become president. That very obvious sort of conclusion and quite predictable conclusion is unfortunately the sort of wave that a Hillary Clinton could ride right into the Oval Office. Now, unfortunately, though, for Hillary at least, she is growing increasingly weaker as Donald Trump is growing increasingly stronger. And where 3 weeks ago, I think on Community Progressive Radio, I said that Hillary Clinton would stomp Donald Trump in a general election. I'm not so sure about that anymore. at this point now, I think it's actually probably the opposite. I think Donald Trump might actually defeat Hillary Clinton. But again, we have to come back to this question of the politics of fear. Now, Tony and I have spoken on numerous occasions about a variety of issues, including Martin Luther King. And Tony likes to cite, and I agree with him, this letter from a Montgomery jail from King.
No,
in which he
Birmingham jail.
Birmingham jail, exactly. in which he warns against the white moderate. okay? And the danger of the white moderate, or what we might call in today's lexicon, the liberal. And this is exactly what I think we need to be aware of now, that the white moderate or the liberal is going to be forced into a position of supplication to a system that they know is wrong, that they know is unjust, that they know is corrupt to the core, but that they will be able to justify it by presenting it as a vote against fascism, as a vote against white supremacy, as a vote against racism, when in fact Hillary Clinton represents all of those things just under the guise of the Democratic Party. I mean, if you look at the slaughter of Black Libyans, if you look at the slaughter going on in various parts of the world that Hillary Clinton is directly responsible for, including the news yesterday of the yet another assassination of an indigenous leader in Honduras, for which Hillary Clinton is directly implicated. All of these things, I think, tell us that liberals are going to be able to now hold their noses and vote for Hillary and justify it politically and morally to themselves by saying it's a vote against Trump. That is the danger, and unfortunately, I think that's where this is going.
Tony?
Yeah, well, I would look at it a bit differently and from a different angle. You see, what I see is something bigger than the 2016 election. And the rebellion of the disaffected, in particular, the disaffected white masses who had either followed, and really the majority had followed the white party, the Republican Party. And this is tens of millions of white working and lower middle class people over the last close to 40 years once again. Now in open rebellion against their elites and against their own political past. On the other side, among white working people who had followed their liberal elites, who were no less hegemonic and imperialistic and neoliberal and kowtowing even perhaps more to Wall Street than the Republican evangelicals. You have an open rebellion against them. Now, what is driving this? It is not Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump. It is what many of us have still not gotten our heads around, the depth of the economic crisis. And people, even establishment economists, are admitting that the unemployment figures don't mean a damn thing, that real unemployment and underemployment in the nation approaches 17%, that 51% of American working people make under $30,000 a year, meaning that the majority of working class people in the United States are in poverty or close to poverty, that the system, not just the political superstructure, not just the party system, the system is in an existential crisis, a crisis far deeper than any of us recognize. Now, can Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump be the expression of that? Well, they can symbolize it. They can ride the wave of it. But the people who are rebelling don't yet have the language, the conceptual framework, the slogans, the methods of fighting that will be necessary. And that is where the left, the genuine left, is challenged to enter this at the level not of the elites, but at the level of the ordinary people. Let me just say that. Now, you know, let me just say one last thing. Concerning Martin Luther King, I think what Eric brings up is very, very important. And he was speaking from a Birmingham jail as a leader of a movement anchored in the South. And that is why when we read King and listen to King about the white moderate and now this unprincipled alliance between the white moderate and the black moderate and so on in the South, I think he is giving us a critique and an angle for understanding what is going on in these initial Southern primaries. I would not take the Southern experience and the Southern primaries as the framework for what's going to happen when we come to Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Ohio and New York going forward.
I agree. I agree. I want to stress something here, though, where I don't know that Tony and I are necessarily disagreeing, other than to say that I would phrase this slightly differently. While, yes, we do see a crisis of capitalism, there's no doubt about that. We see an economic crisis that is only deepening. All of the objective material indicators, from unemployment to infant mortality to poverty to hunger and all of these other things, all of them indicate the kind of crisis, long-term crisis, that the working class and the poor in particular have been facing. At the same time, though, we do have a historical parallels that we can look at, including, you know, just a couple of generations ago, and the danger that we face, of course, with somebody like a Hillary Clinton or a Donald Trump or a Bernie Sanders or whomever, is that whomever ultimately ends up in the White House, in whatever way they end up getting there, even if it's in a sort of serpentine, you know, fashion, that the objective conditions globally are such that there is no changing the course. And the course is, of course, and I certainly don't mean to sound too fatalistic here, but the course is one towards a very, very dark period in the world. If you look at the
could I just interrupt you, Eric, just quickly? I would just ask, what, you know, see, the United States is the largest economy in the world, with all of the contradictions that implies. Being the largest does not mean being the strongest. It does suggest being that economy where the contradictions between the people and the financial elite are probably the sharpest. I would just ask you the question, how do you factor in, or do you agree that we are looking at, in our very life world, systemic meltdown, and that this crisis of the political parties are but a symbolic reflection of a deeper systemic unraveling?
I would agree with that. However, I would take 2008 as an interesting sort of let's call it a microcosm. What is the principal concept that emerges out of the economic crisis of 2008? The principal concept, in my mind, which is now standard in our understanding and in the lexicon, and that is too big to fail. And I think that the United States, politically speaking and economically speaking, might fall under the rubric of too big to fail. And who is determining that it's too big to fail? It is the global economic ruling class. It is that transnational capitalist class, which does not reside within the borders of the United States exclusively, whose influence and whose interests extend all over the globe. They are the ones who are looking at these indicators. They're looking at everything from the collapse of global oil prices to the ongoing friction with Russia to the encirclement of China to all of these geopolitical machinations that are happening. And they're saying that if they are looking at a global economic meltdown, as Tony said, and I agree with him, that what is their alternative? How do they save themselves from that? Well, historically, the way that they have done it is with world war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And Eric, you know, and I listened to your commentary about geostrategic matters all the time, and I'm in agreement most of the time. However, you see, I don't think the period between World Wars One and Two fit exactly this moment in history, because that period was a period where the vast majority of humanity lived under one or another form of colonialism or semi-colonialism. There was no Chinese economy. There was no Chinese army and air force, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There was no alliance of China and Russia. If you remember, in the 1930s, it was a joint agreement between British and American imperialism and German fascism. If you go to the Soviet Union, there'll be no problem. Now, I think that with the collapse of the European Union, and, you know, we talk about the United States and China, but Europe is still the largest economy, if you take the European Union, in the world. That is in crisis. I don't think the ruling classes of the world, and there is not a single ruling class, the ruling classes of the world can find a common, united front to resolving the crisis of systemic meltdown. And I mean that. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I want to say, and Don, I'm not trying to crowd you out if you want to jump in.
Go ahead. I'm listening.
Yeah, I wanted to say that I agree with Tony. I agree with you, Tony, to a point, but I don't believe that the parallels have to be exact. And I don't think that the conditions right now are the same as, you know, 1925 to 1935. No, I don't. Mm-hmm. But if we take an even longer view of history, the beginning of each of the last five centuries has seen a global war of some kind in which the previous imperial system, the previous dominant imperial power, is on the decline, and it comes into direct conflict with the emerging imperial powers, the emerging global system. So let's just look very quickly at these examples. 1914, almost exactly 100 years ago, the imperial powers find themselves in conflict with each other in their division of the global economic spoils, and it leads to a global war. Exactly 100 years before that, in 1810, 1814, that period, you have the Napoleonic Wars, in which the naval dominance of the British Empire comes into direct conflict and contradiction with the continental imperial power of France. Exactly 100 years before that, you have the War of Spanish Succession, in which the British Empire and the continental empires find themselves in direct conflict over the remnants of the Spanish Empire. Exactly 100 years before that, we have a 30 years war, as it's called now, which is essentially a European continental conflagration, which caused the deaths of anything between one quarter and one half of the European population. All of these in their time seemed like global wars. And I think that what we're looking at today is essentially the 21st century version, maybe in the early stages, of a global war. If you look at Syria, if you look at Ukraine, if you look at the destabilizations in Latin America, if you look at the South China Sea, all of these different places, these are simply flashpoints of what I think should be understood as the early stages of a new global war. Maybe it's a low-intensity global war at this point, but that is, I think, what we're looking at. And so while I agree with Tony that the parallel with 1930 might not be exact, in the broader historical context, I do think it applies.
You know, just not for nothing.
Oh, sorry.
It's and that whole idea, Eric. You should write a book and flesh that out or something, and I'll help you with some grunt work. The whole thing that I've been saying for 3 or 4 years, 5 years even, looking back to 2011, take a look at a map. and look at everything that's going on that map and take the position of a military planner sitting in the Pentagon. You're conducting a war. Maybe the other guy doesn't know he is, but you're conducting a war, a global war.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt. That's exactly what we're witnessing. And again, I mean, depending on how you want to look at it, whether you want to look at China and Russia as, you know, slight variations of the kind of capitalism that we know, whether you want to say that China is, you know, communism with capitalist characteristics, or however you want to describe it, ultimately, the question is not what you think of Russia and China. The question is, what is the relation of those powers that are outside of what I call the imperial system, the U.S., Europe, U.K., NATO, Western, quote-unquote, imperial system, those countries that find themselves on the outside of that, who are not being given a seat at the table to their liking, who are not being given the respect, be it political, economic, or social, cultural, that they believe is due to them, how do they respond to this? And the emergence of BRICS, the emergence of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, China's One Belt, One Road, the New Silk Road, all of these initiatives, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, Russia's Eurasian Economic Union, all of these new multilateral non-Western institutions, if you take them as a whole, they represent a challenge to the imperial hegemony. Okay?
Absolutely.
This is a conflict between these forces.
Yep. Absolutely. And that's the point. You see, all of the examples that you gave had to do with the rise of Europe as the center of this new system that we now call capitalism. And then the wars of the 20th century were the wars over how to globalize and consolidate one of the other European powers' command and control of the world system. But the world system today is vastly different, I would say qualitatively different than what it was then. And the vast majority of the human race were on the sidelines to these European conflicts over which or the other nation would control the rest of humanity. Now, increasingly and progressively, the rest of humanity is involved in determining the fate of the human race as a whole. Now, I do not rule out, and nor would I be so naive to rule out, a desperate act on the part of especially the U.S. militarists. And it would probably come from, and I agree with Eric on this, people around Hillary Clinton, because she has within her ranks, within her elite foreign policy thinkers, the most aggressive imperialist hegemonic forces, including Elizabeth Nuland, Samantha Powers, and Mrs. Rice in the national security. I mean, so they would be the ones more predisposed to a desperate act like that. And they would be challenged, of course, even by people in the Pentagon, not to mention those for whom these wars have meant impoverishment and austerity. The very people that are at the center of the Trump and Bernie Sanders rebellions at this time. My point is simply this. We cannot take the threat of fascism or war off of the table. But at the same time, we must not see them as inevitable. And a lot depends upon how we, the left, broadly speaking, and not in a sectarian party left or whatever kind of construal, but broadly considered, the left must now rise to the challenge ideologically, politically, organizationally, of mobilizing masses who are already in rebellion and clarifying what we believe is to be done and what are the possible paths going forward. That's all I'm saying. Okay. I'm saying we cannot overlook the danger, but we cannot at the same time overlook the positive situation that exists for us.
I think we can wrap there, Eric and Professor Montero. I appreciate it. Analyst Eric Dreitzer from StopImperialism.org and Professor Anthony Montero, thank you very much. Larry Hamm, who chairs the People's Organization for Progress based in Newark, New Jersey, spoke with CPR's Bernard White via telephone Thursday.
I think we're facing a kind of political crisis, it seems, in the United States. If it's not a political crisis, then what we're facing is certainly, I think, a political sea change. That the whole character, maybe not in a fundamental way, but in a way significant enough for people to notice, to feel, we're facing a political sea change. Who would have guessed, you know, that this presidential election, you know, that the Ku Klux Klan would become an issue, you know, and, you know, who would have guessed that we would have had a guy running for president actually identifying himself as a democratic socialist, you know, and then even giving a whole speech on what his concept of socialism is, you know, who could have guessed these things? And I think it symbolizes a kind of evolution in politics, if not a kind of crisis. Because now you have a situation in the Republican Party where the mainstream establishment Republican Party people are not in agreement with who is shaping up to be, who is Donald Trump shaping up to be the possible party nominee. And there's actually the possibility that the Republicans will go into a brokered convention, and that will be the first time that has happened in more than 40 years in the United States. And on the Democratic Party side, here you have Hillary Clinton, whose husband at one point was one of the leaders of the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Council of the Democratic Party, which came into being, I believe, in the aftermath of the Jesse Jackson campaign and then the Dukakis campaign, who came into being with the stated purpose of shifting the Democratic Party to the left, to the right, because they felt that the party with Jackson and with Dukakis had shifted too far to the left.
And they wanted to make sure that they maintained power, because Jackson came in with some folks who were considered to be outsiders, and they did not want to relinquish power, so they set up a parallel government to organization to supersede what was developing.
Right, and think about it. They set up a parallel organization to the Democratic Party constitutional structure. I mean, it's one thing to talk about the party mainstream and the party establishment. That wasn't right enough for them. They had to set something else up to make sure, to ensure that, you know, it would shift back or at least stay in the hands of the conservative elements of the Democratic Party. And now the wife of one of those who was at the center of that effort, Bill Clinton, was at the center of that effort with one of our senators. People may not believe this, but I believe Bill Bradley, former U.S. senator, former basketball player, was also part of that effort. Now the wife of Bill Clinton is running and adopting some of the left, well, what one might call left populist rhetoric of her opponent, the guy that identifies himself as a socialist. So we see that this election, at least in its rhetoric and in its campaign efforts, is clearly not in the mold of previous elections of the last at least 60 years.
I think also what it reflects, or what we're looking at, is the consolidation of disaffection on both the Republicans as well as the Democrats.
Disaffection, yes.
Yeah, that people are really tired of the Democratic establishment.
That is the case. I agree with you 100%. I would just say this. I think that it's disaffection, it's characterized by a consolidation of disaffection in both parties. But I would have to say this, and I know some people might disagree. I would have to say white disaffection, because black people have been disaffected since we got here. But in terms of presidential elections, we have especially been disaffected since the election of Richard Nixon in 1968. I mean, especially disaffected. Remember, it was Nixon that put in place the Southern Strategy and began this whole shift, you know, where the white folks came out of the Democratic Party and went into the Republican Party in response to the civil rights and other social civil rights movement and other social movements that were going on in the country in the 60s. In the changes that began in the 50s and going into through the 60s. But what we are seeing, I think, is one, a general disaffection, but I think also specifically it's the disaffection of whites that is really, I think, at the core of this. Mm-hmm. Because I think white people are now feeling the full effect of the economic crisis that this country has faced really since the end of the Clinton years. Whites are being faced with unemployment. They're also being faced with the foreclosure crisis. They're also being faced with seeing their status slip from being middle class to working class, and even some of them have slipped into poverty. That's some of the stuff they face on the economic side, and then on the cultural side, and this especially, I think, relates to those who are on the right. They are disaffected. Especially disaffected. They see the power shifting in America, whereas black people were totally locked out. I think the election of Barack Obama, the first black president of the United States, or the first black president in this contemporary period, they see that as emblematic of a perceived shift where the power is no longer in white hands, or firmly in white hands, and this Make America Great Again is slogan that Trump has been touting is really a kind of dog whistle, you know, for the return of white, of blatant and open white power.
Right. So, yeah, the whole cry of "We want our country back." What do you mean?
That's right. You know, there's a South African word. There's an Afrikaner word, and I heard it once, and I used to hear it, you know, during the anti-apartheid period, when the, you know, just before Nelson Mandela was released, or right after Mandela was released, and it was absolutely clear that the apartheid regime was going to fall. And they were talking about how that was affecting the white minority in South Africa, especially the Afrikaners, and how on the one hand there were some whites, you know, who were trying to prepare for the inevitable, but there were other whites, especially amongst the Afrikaners, who we used to say in cinema parlance, circling up the wagon. Mm-hmm. You remember we watched cowboy movies, and when the Indians would come, the wagon train master would say, circle up the wagon.
That's right.
And then they would fight the Indians from inside that circle. Well, there's actually an Afrikaner word for that circling of the wagons, because just like the cowboy stories are part of the American mythology, they have a similar mythology in South Africa, where the whites were fighting the indigenous people who were African. And there was an Afrikaner word for circling up the wagons. And they were talking about how the Afrikaners were mentally circling up their wagon, you know, because they felt that they were under siege and that they were going to lose not just their privilege in the case of South Africa, that they were going to lose the country. And I think we're seeing that similar, if not same phenomenon, maybe not as openly, but certainly existing nonetheless, that a lot of white people feel under siege, that the white privilege that they had and the kind of society that they lived in, they see it all changing before their eyes, and it's creating a kind of crisis mentality, you know, amongst them. And so a lot of them are rushing, you know, to people, to demagogues like Donald Trump, but not exclusively. I mean, what we say about Donald Trump, we would have to say about all the Republican candidates, because Trump has forced those who would like to, you know, talk in more moderate tones in order to gain votes and build a winning electoral strategy. He's forced them to unmask themselves, that their moderate tones were really just a mask for the same policy outcome. You know, so all of them were talking that talk, maybe not as strident as Trump, but certainly with regard to policy, you know, saying basically the same things policy-wise. And, you know, this is a kind of crisis, and a lot of regular working-class white. And you hear, if you listen to the news, you hear certain terms that you don't hear too much in regular American media discourse. Like, I've heard the word class used more in this election than I've ever, and especially the word working class, you know, working class whites. You know, I hear that term so often now. And you didn't hear that kind of talk a lot. I mean, some people used it, but you didn't hear a lot of that in past elections. But now, almost every conversation is, well, this is how working class whites feel. Remember, they used to say blue collar, right?
Yeah.
But you notice they haven't been saying blue collar that much. They're saying working class whites. Hmm. You know, and another term I've heard, because they don't want to use the word white racism, I've heard some commentators that say Trump is attracting white nationalists. Have you heard that? I've heard that, not on the progressive radio stations, but even on some of these regular television news and talk programs. They're talking about white nationalists. Well, why don't they just say it? These are neo-Nazis and Klansmen. They're white racists, but they don't want to say white racists. Hmm. You know, they want to say white nationalists.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm like, well, define that. What is a white nationalist?
You know, the other night I was watching a clip of Mussolini, and you know his histrionics, how he used to move in front of the microphone, and if you took Mussolini and put him in a suit and put him right next to Donald Trump and, you know, turn the volume off, you see that these guys moved in a quite similar ways.
Yes. In fact, Bernard, it is amazing to me that you just said this, because just the other day I was looking at these pictures that the New York Post puts on the front page of with Donald Trump and even the Daily News. I mean, there's some real colorful journalism. We used to learn about journalism in high school, and they talk about yellow journalism, but they always describe the tabloids with the yellow journalism. But there's more colors going on than yellow now. The news, the Daily News and the New York Post, they're fighting it out. And on the front page of the Daily News, Trump, they actually had the word of the apocalypse. It wasn't yesterday. They had apocalypse over the picture with Donald Trump. And I guess that's supposed to symbolize that he represented the Antichrist to people, that this guy is the Antichrist. You know, but with regard to what you were saying about Mussolini, if you look at some of Donald Trump's photographs, he uses the same scowl. And I don't know if this is purposeful or if it's a coincidence. He uses the same kind of scowl on his face that Mussolini used. The popular pictures that we saw of Mussolini, he'd always have his arms, as they say, arms akimbo, with his both fists on his hips, you know. And he would never have like a smile. It would be a scowl, a frown. As people say, frown. And Trump uses that same kind of expression, and they do look alike. I mean, if you look at the pictures, they look frighteningly alike. Trump actually quoted Mussolini. He used this quote from Mussolini about being lions rather than lambs or something like that. And one of the reporters asked him about it, and he said that he didn't have any problem with the quote. He said it was still an interesting quote. Now, just think about that. This is a country that fought a war against the fascists, against the Axis. And we can have a guy run for president, quote the leader of one of the countries we fought, our soldiers fought and died against in World War II, and nobody's calling him out on it. You know? Nobody's calling out. And then the other thing I heard is that in the Klan, amongst the Klan and neo-Nazi groups that are supporting Trump, they are referring to him as our glorious leader. So this thing is getting really deep here, you know, and I guess this is why the Republicans, the Republican establishment, is now moving to try to block Trump from the nomination. But this is a really, I won't say dangerous yet, but it could become a very tense situation politically, at least on the Republican side, because it's clear that a lot of these establishment, see, they don't want to lose the whole thing. What they see in Trump is not someone who can win the presidency, but someone who could possibly destroy the Republican Party and cause them to lose everything that they have. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is that, yes, they want the White House, but they also want to maintain control of the House and the Senate. And if Trump, the more Trump goes forward, the more he unmasks the racist and reactionary elements that are now in the tent, well, have always been in the tent, but are now being exposed in being in the tent of the Republican Party. and that this could cause a lot of folks to vote against Republicans, not just for the White House, but also in the Congress and in the Senate.
Right. You know, they've suckled the sentiments for the last 8 years, and now they have a full-grown adult. It has become,
yes.
It has matured.
It's a Frankenstein monster. You know, it's a Frankenstein monster that's come back to destroy them, not destroy them in the you know, in the stricto sensu, but to cause them to lose their power. Remember, in the 30s, after the Great Depression and during the Roosevelt years, the Republican Party had hit a nadir. They didn't have a majority in the House. They didn't have a majority in the Senate. They didn't have the White House. In fact, they had a Democratic president who ran for an unprecedented fourth term. Unprecedented. He died. Roosevelt died in his fourth term. They don't want to return to a situation like that where they are totally out of power. And they see that the possible outcome of all of this could be the loss of the House and of the Senate. If you get a Democratic president in there, then there's a possibility of them losing the judiciary. Remember, these Republican presidents over the last 40 years, Nixon, Reagan, George Bush the first, and George Bush the second, they packed the Supreme Court with conservative appointees, and that's how you got this reactionary Supreme Court we've had for the last 8 years. But now with the death of Scalia, there's a possibility that Obama will get to appoint one before he goes. And then if there's a Democratic president, they could appoint another two, possibly three. And that would ensure a liberal court for possibly several decades.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.